Okay, so we're in the book of Esther, and we're going to be starting in chapter 7. And just to catch us up very quickly, remember that Esther is the queen now. Haman has launched his plan to hang Mordecai on his gallows, but in the meantime, while the gallows is going up, the king can't sleep, and he asks for the chronicles to be brought to him, and he learns in the chronicles, or is reminded in the chronicles, of the fact that Mordecai had foiled a plot to kill him, and when he determines that he had not been repaid for his kindness, the king determines that he will, and here comes Haman, and so he asks Haman, well, what would you do for a guy that you wanted to honor above anybody in the kingdom? And Haman thought it was him, and he really, really talked it up, and he told Haman to make it so. And so Haman has just gotten back from the parade, where he's paraded Mordecai through the streets on the king's horse and robe, and all decked out, and proclaiming before him, such will it be done for the man that the king desires to honor. And you can imagine how that is just killing Haman. That may have hurt more than the hanging, you know. But we're coming to that. So chapter 7, the king and Haman, they come to drink wine with Esther the queen, which of course is a shortened form of just to say that they've come to the feast. The king has already done this once, and Esther said, come to my second feast, and I will answer your question. So the queen now the king now asks the question of the queen in verse 2. What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done. Now, if that sounds exactly like what he said before, it's because it is. It's a formula. It's a formula of the court. And often in a kingdom, and the king is speaking, there are formulas for things like this. And so Queen Esther answers and says, if I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition and my people as my request. Now, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Save my life. Save the lives of my people. She goes on, for we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. Now, this, I mean, you take verses 3 and 4 and just analyze the way Queen Esther has laid this out before the king. Queen Esther expresses herself in an extremely eloquent way. When you think about the approach that she takes, she begins with the idea of the life of my people, of myself and my people. She expresses it as having been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And so we have a triple use of description here in order to, and it gets stronger and stronger as you go. If we had only been sold as slaves, I wouldn't bother you. You know, you're important. You have bigger things on your mind. And if we'd just been sold as, and so there's humility in this. There is a desire to not be bothersome to the king, the statement, the plea that she makes, it just exudes wisdom and eloquence. And King Ahasuerus asked the king, asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do this? You got to just wonder what in the world is going through Haman's mind. He's sitting here and he's thinking, you know, and remember, he doesn't know that Esther is a Jew. And so you have to wonder how far ahead on this he is. But even though he doesn't know that Esther's a Jew, why might he very quickly have an inkling that this is about me? I'm sorry? Because he's also invited to the feast. I hadn't really thought about that, but yeah, that is a good reason to think, wow, now I know why I'm here. Right.
And I and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated.
Right.
So that right there tells me he's already starting to get clues.
Okay. But Queen Esther says that, but does Haman know that Queen Esther is a Jew?
No.
Yes. Well, that's my point. I think there's a very good reason to think that he does have an inkling, but there's a reason why I think that may be. And if you want a clue, it's in the previous chapter. It's at the end of the previous chapter. And so, remember when Haman comes back in shame and he just, you know, he's kind of like a dog with his tail between his legs as he comes in the front door. And he tells his wife and his friends everything that had happened. And his wife and his friends, what do they say to him? Yeah? They, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Now, when did that happen? It happened right before the servants came to take him. This is on his mind, right? This is still on his mind. And so I have to think that even though he doesn't know that she's a Jew, he may be getting a pretty clear picture from what has just happened. He's just paraded Mordecai through the streets. That all got turned around on him. And what if? And so I look at this, and here's the king saying, who is he and where is he? And I can just kind of imagine that maybe Haman is sitting there, and he's thinking, oh, please don't let it be me. Please don't let it be me. Please don't let it be me, because this is bad. Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. What a sentence. Just one sentence. That's all she needed. She didn't go anywhere else. I mean, she is the queen. Well, pardon the pun. Didn't mean to do that. She is the queen of brevity. She is the queen of apropos. And she just tells it like it is, and boom, she leaves it there. I mean, could she have said more? She could have gone on and on and on and on and on, couldn't she? There's no point. And she knows it. A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. He knows what this means. And the king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went out into the palace garden. You ever been so angry that you just had to get away from the situation? I mean, you just had to. Maybe you had enough calm that you could say, excuse me, and you left. Or maybe you just, your face was turning so red and the vessels were busting out and you just had to get out the door anyway. That's what I see in the king. He is so angry. And this shows a great deal of diplomacy on his part, from the standpoint that Haman isn't just anyone. If we look at this from a historical standpoint, we might make the mistake of looking at this and saying, King Ahasuerus wouldn't have cared. he would have just said, off with his head, and taken care of it right then. But Haman's not just anyone. He's promoted Haman all the way up. So this kind of reflects on him too, doesn't it? I mean, who are you putting in command, King Ahasuerus? And so he really needs to think about this. And so he arose in his anger. He goes to the palace garden, which for the Persians had a beautiful palace garden in Susa. We know that from history. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now, I want you to imagine the sight here, because we usually don't get it when we read this and we study this. And so what has he been doing from the beginning of the book of Esther? He's been trying to get Mordecai to bow to him and do homage. What's he doing? What's Haman doing? He's bowing before Esther. Can you see him on his knees? He's begging and he's pleading for his life. The turn of events in chapter 6, that's nothing compared to what we see right here. But usually when we read chapter 6 and we come to that part where Haman's leading the horse through the streets, we just revel in the imagery of that. But we don't stop right here long enough to even think that here is a Jewish woman. What was the problem in chapter 1? Vashti had disrespected King Ahasuerus. And what was going to be the big repercussion?
Kill all the dudes.
Well, that's where it eventually goes. But the immediate repercussion is... Those women folk. They're not going to be respecting the princes in the kingdom. And we've got to make sure we keep those women folk in the right place, right? And so what is Haman doing? He's not just bowing to a Jew. He's bowing to a Jewish woman. Forget the fact that she's a queen. For Haman, Jews are a hated people, and yet he's bowing before a Jewish woman. And not only that, he is bowing before her to plead for his life. And so, she has what over him? Power. She has power over him. This is so poignant. So, in verse 8, now, when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Okay, so you can see him, you know, he's on his knees, and it's not that he's climbing on her. That's not the picture. The point is that he's bowing before her and he's pleading with her, probably making unintelligible noises with weeping, knowing what could be about to happen. And so when the king sees him falling on the couch, what is he thinking?
Are you even going to attack the queen while I'm here?
Yeah, here I am and you're attacking my queen? I mean, that's crazy. I mean, do that in a game of chess, but you're not going to do that with me. I'm in the house and here she is, and no. And so you can imagine, as angry as the king was when he walked out the door, he comes back in the door, and what does it look like now? Oh, he is furious. He is furious. And keep in mind that in the royal court, the servants... And of course, we imagine that that Haman and Esther are all by themselves in this room, and that would not have been the case. There would have been servants that would have been standing by. They would have been watching for opportunities to serve the king and the queen, to do whatever was necessary. And it wasn't their and it wasn't just their job to wait for the king to say, more wine. It was their job to be on it before it was asked. And that's a little hard for us to imagine, but that's what they were trained to do. And so we find the king saying, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Okay, they're on it. They probably didn't like what was going on either, even though they may have seen a little more of the context. They probably didn't like it either, but they could see what his face was doing, and they're going to cover Haman's face. We don't have, I've never been able to find any history on this practice of covering the prisoner's face, but it appears that the point of it is to make sure that you take the fight out of the prisoner. It's really kind of hard, unless you're Kwai Chang Kane and you know Kung Fu. It's really kind of hard if you can't see to fight anybody. So what you do is you cover their face. You know, that's what you do with a horse. If you got a barn on fire, how do you get the horse out of there? First thing you do is you cover that horse's head. If it can see, you're not going to get it out of that barn. So they'll cover the head of the horse first, and then it is easier. I didn't say easy. I said easier to get the horse out of the barn. And so they cover Haman's face, and the point is, and the point is not that that's the only thing they did. That's simply a euphemism for them apprehending him and securing him. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, and so this is one of those servants who is there on this occasion. And I love this. He's ready. He's ready. It makes me a little bit suspicious from the standpoint that, you know, we look at this whole thing like when we see the relationship between Esther and Mordecai and the fact that they were Jews, we imagine that they were the only ones who knew that they were Jews and no one else was in on any of that. And that isn't true. And we know it isn't true because Esther and Mordecai have been sending messages back and forth to each other. You know, she tells one of her eunuchs, go and tell Mordecai. She doesn't say, oh, here, let me write out a message for you. And then she puts it in an envelope and she seals it so it's known whether it's... No, she says, go and tell him. And when he goes back to Esther, Mordecai has said, go and tell her. And so, do you think anybody in the palace knows? Yeah. There's a funny thing about, you know, if you like to watch some of the old British comedy, I won't watch any of the new British comedy, but the old stuff, like the old murder mysteries, and you've got the servants. And of course, if you want to know anything, who do you go to? Yeah, you go to the servants. And they won't know who done it, but they can give you lots of great information. And the funny thing is, you know, the whole thing is they talk among themselves. Well, does that sound reasonable?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell you what, if I was a servant in a big, huge manor, there's not much else to do but clean the silverware and you know, do whatever else that a servant does. You know, if there's some gossip going on, you know, that's That's a part of it all. But the funny thing about it is it runs from house to house, and your house isn't the only one that knows what's going on in your house. It's going on other places. Now, the point is this. You've got servants who are in the know here, and I would suggest to you that quite a number of servants probably know about some of the goings-on and doings and what's about to happen and how it relates to Esther, and they love Esther. I mean, you might say, well, that was a terrible risk. You know, the servants, they could have ratted Esther out. Yeah, they could have, but not if they love Esther. And so go back to the beginning of the book of Esther and read the book of Esther from the standpoint of a servant in that palace, and ask yourself, how much would the servants love Esther? And while you're thinking about that, you might kind of go back and ask yourself, was Vashti, the former queen, was she really the kind of woman that would have truly inspired a love and a loyalty in her servants? Well, she kind of looks arrogant to me. And I kind of wonder, she may have mistreated the servants. And so I'm thinking, when they get Esther, this is a breath of fresh air. They're not messing this up. So no, they're not going to go and tell anyone. And so I'm just saying that we've got this eunuch, and he serves before the king. His name is Harbona. And he immediately, as soon as all of this is going on, he says, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king." And the king said, "Hang him on it." I find it interesting that Harbona had all of that put together in his mind. He had it ready to spit out right here. They've covered his head and secured him. And now the king hadn't even asked, well, what do we do with him now? And it doesn't even look like he had much time to even think about it. But Harbona has. Kind of makes me wonder if he may have been as mean to Harbona as he was to some other people in the city gate. So, we read that they hanged Haman on this basically seven-story high gallows that he had built for Mordecai. And the king's anger subsided. Chapter 7 is just packed. It's just amazing. Let's get the reward real quick in chapter 8. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. Now that's interesting. And we find that Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet and wept. And of course, what is the problem? Well, that I don't think that's so much. The king extends the golden scepter in verse 4. And so she gets that. But why is she weeping? Yes, her people. The edict is still in place. We're still going to exterminate all the Jews by royal edict. And so so she pleads with the king. And of course, the law that was made, it cannot be revoked. We see that in the book of Daniel. That's just a law of the Medes and the Persians. You can say, well, that's a dumb law, but in the past, they saw a reason to put that law in place. And so it's a funny law. Well, maybe it's not so much that it's a funny law as that there is a funny thing about the law. If you make a law that says you cannot change any law of the Medes and the Persians, then what law can you never rescind? I'm sorry? That's true, but there's another law. It's a law you know about, because I just told you. It becomes an eternal law, doesn't it? You can't, you know, it's not like you can go into Congress next week and say, well, we don't like that law, we're taking it out. No, the law is, you can't change it. Okay, so you just set that law in place forever, or until the kingdom falls. And so they do come up with their solution, and that is that he makes an edict where the Jews have full legal right to take their vengeance on the enemies, their enemies, who wanted to see them destroyed. And we find that that edict is created, it's sealed with the signet ring, and then sent out all over throughout the 127 provinces of the Persian Empire. And we find that when that particular day comes, we find, and this is it, we've gotten all the way to chapter 9. I know you can't believe I got through chapter 8 so fast after spending so long in chapter 7. But we're now in chapter 9. And so when that day comes, the Jews are able to take their revenge on the people who were wanting to exterminate them. This enabled them not only to take the lives of those people, but also to take their property, which, of course, was what they were going to do to the Jews. We actually have a number in verse 16, and that is 75,000 of those who hated them. So we have this. We have this going forward. Okay. Any questions? Thoughts? Nothing? Okay. The Feast of Purim, as I mentioned several weeks ago when we began the book, Feast of Purim is actually celebrated to this day by the Jews. It is a celebration of this this redemption, if you will, this salvation that came to them on this particular occasion. It is actually celebrated on the date that Haman had determined by casting lots that was the day they were going to exterminate the Jews. So now that is kept. We read, let's see now. Okay, we might point out the fact that I thought... Verse 25, that's what I'm looking for. That he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. So the point of... Now, of course, what would be the point of killing Haman's sons? This was the usual procedure in kingdoms... in transfers of power, especially where a king, if you take out a king, you're going to take out his sons too. And why is that? I'm sorry? Yeah, you're going to keep the sons from coming back to haunt you. And so they're, what are they going to do? Well, they may have some power pockets. They may have some people, some friends in fairly high places, and they can begin to mount a rebellion and a coup in order to take out the king. Well, of course, the king has had Haman killed, He certainly doesn't want Haman's sons around for them to engage in any kind of retribution. So we find that they are killed as well. We read beginning in verse 29, then Queen Esther, daughter of Habihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm the second letter about Purim. They sent it into the 127 provinces in order to establish this particular feast, that it be observed and commemorated. We find in chapter 10 that King Ahasuerus laid a tribute on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, accomplishments of his authority, and we have this ending up the book in chapter 10. Now, I want to make a couple of points here. I might make the first point, and that is on how they celebrate Purim. It's the closest thing they have to Halloween. You know why? It's not a joke. I'm sorry? Yes, they wear costumes, exactly. And they wear costumes, and the reason why they're wearing costumes when they celebrate Purim is it is to commemorate them hiding their identity at this time. Okay? So the costume is the idea of hiding their identity. So that just in case you ever want to celebrate it, you're going to have to get you a costume, and you may not want to go as a pig. Now, what was the second thing I wanted to point out? Oh, the book of Esther. Remember from the beginning we've pointed out that the name of God is never found in it. Never found in it. And as we come to the end of this, and we've looked at the way, particularly chapter 9 is formulated, the way it is put together, the book actually may come from the Chronicles of Persia. And that's why the name of God is not in it. You say, oh, well, then it's not an inspired book. I did not say that. Because we don't know for certain who wrote it, but who is a likely candidate for who did write it?
Mordecai.
Okay, so And I told you at the very beginning, the name of the book is Esther. But is Esther really the main character? No. I mean, she's the most endearing character, isn't she? She's definitely the most endearing. But Mordecai is the one who really becomes the main character in the book. And I find that incredibly interesting, since we always just assume that, well, main character's Esther. Now, I gave you, before I go to the assignment, it wasn't really an assignment, question I asked you. Before I go to that, any questions or thoughts? Okay, so I had mentioned the idea of a type and anti-type in this. And, maybe that's why it won't do it. Okay, I'm not going to get that. I'm sorry. Sometimes it makes you wonder why you spent all that time typing that chart in. Okay, so what is a type anti-type? A type anti-type is the idea of shadow and substance. Now, we all understand the idea of something that has substance creating a shadow. So I hold this right here, and there's a shadow right here on the pulpit. This is the substance. This is the shadow. The shadow is the type, and the substance is the anti-type. Now, I know, you know, for a lot of us, to me, that sounds backward. It sounds like the substance should actually be the type. But think of it as the type on a page, like those of you who can remember typewriters, when you had that die striking a ribbon and putting the ink on the page. And when you strike it, you have the type on the page. But the type is only the image of what made it. The antitype is that actual little lever that came up that has that die with a reverse image of what you wanted to go on the page. And that is the substance. And so that is the antitype. Types and antitypes, then, are the idea of something in literature, just speaking of it generally, where you have something of substance that is actually has a shadow that it casts. In Scripture, the most famous would be the shadows of the Old Testament tabernacle, and how Christ and His sacrifice and Him at the right hand of God, that is all a shadow. It is, or that is all the substance that created the shadow of the tabernacle in the Old Testament. So you had the high priest, you had the holy of holy place, you had the altar, you had sacrifices, but all of that was just a shadow of where God was going with it. So the question is it possible that there is a type antitype here in the book of Esther? I would say I'm not so sure, but since it can be taken to really far-flung lengths and you can find some really crazy things, I just want to give you some of the more likely possibilities before we run out of time. Mordecai, in chapter 2 and verse 6, we read that he was exiled to Babylon. In other words, he was alive when the exile took place and he went to Babylon. In Matthew 2, 14 through 15, Jesus went to Egypt. But not only that, but Jesus was in a sense exiled to earth, to this world, in order to do the will of God. 1 Timothy 1, verse 15. Jesus was told by Satan, and Satan in this, by the way, becomes the antitype for Haman, who is the shadow. Jesus was told, or Haman told Mordecai to bow to him, right? He expected him to bow, chapter 3 and verse 2. Jesus would not bow to Satan. You'll remember in the temptations that the last one in Matthew 4, verses 8 through 10 was, if you bow to me, I'll give you all these kingdoms. And Jesus would not bow. In chapter 3 and verse 6, Haman was an enemy who sought to destroy God's people. Satan seeks to destroy not only Jesus, but all of God's people. Chapter 4 and verse 4, when he finds out about the decree, the condition of his people, there was no comfort that could dissuade Haman from his intention to get Esther to go before the king. Remember, she sent clothes out to him. He's out there in sackcloth, and she sends clothes. He would not accept any comfort. In Matthew 16, 21 through 23, Jesus tells the disciples, "We're going up to Jerusalem. They're going to take me. They're going to put me to death." And what does Peter say? "Not so, Lord. This will never happen to you." And what did Jesus say? "Get behind me, Satan." So Jesus would not be comforted or dissuaded from his intention. Mordecai is the counselor in the book of Esther who actually brings light. Chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. He is the one who counsels Esther on going before the king. Jesus is the one that brings light into the world, and he brings the knowledge of salvation. And then finally, we find that Mordecai was exalted and obviously takes a position over Haman. Haman dies, but he is now put in charge of Haman's household. Jesus is exalted, and he's exalted to the right hand of God. And of course, the eventuality of that is that our great oppressor, just as Haman was, our great oppressor, he's going to go the same route. And that's to destruction. He's got a place that's prepared for him. Well, I'm sorry, if you want to come up after services and take a picture of that, if you want. I know you probably couldn't take notes as fast as I was going, but the bell's about to ring. That's all we have for Esther. John isn't here, but I'm sure he realized that we are wrapping up Esther pretty quick, so he's going to start his study next week on the 17 time periods. And if he has to work, I guess maybe I'll find out what he's going to do, and then I'll do that instead. So, okay.